All right. Well, this was a podcast that had to happen. We had to get this no matter what. And it was within our means. We could have gotten this.
Well, it's within your means, my friend. I hooked my, like the little prince, I caught the star known as Danko Jones and sailed away to the, to this interview.
And that voice is Damien Abraham. And it was me and Damien doing in Australia for the Soundwave Festival. And my band was playing with
Duff McKagan's Loaded.
That's right.
Featuring Slash. No, just kidding. Duff McKagan.
Well, a nice bunch of guys.
Great dudes. Like, yeah. The whole band is
Jeff Rouse, Mike Squires, and Burke. I can't remember his last name.
I'm trying to remember Burke's last name.
Yeah. But a really nice bunch of guys, and really backing, arguably, not even arguably, the nicest guy in rock and roll.
Yeah. Like, I would say, given his position in music and given the band he was in, he is, you know, defies all expectations you would have about what he would be like to talk to. I had like visions of the American Music Awards playing in my head, like, thanks to the fucking award.
Yeah, I remember
like,
that.
Yeah, and I was like, then like, what's he going to be like? But he is just like an awesome dude. And like, if you read his book, which is a great book,
it's so easy,
worth picking up.
Yeah,
it comes across that he seems like a really good guy in that book. And then meeting him in person, it's like, oh, that's
not too far off.
Not too far at all.
In fact, it's exactly how, once you finish reading the book, you picture him in your head.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he comes off, like, the person you read is the person you meet.
Yeah, and I believe, well, he's a writer. He writes for Seattle Weekly and various other things, and I've seen him on his laptop writing and getting, you know, he's very approachable on this whole tour. We spent 2 weeks with him, and I don't think he wrote with a ghostwriter at all. It's so easy.
No,
it was him.
Yeah, and it really, it does sound like his voice in that book. Yeah. And when you talk to him, it definitely sounds like his voice. And yeah, like, it was just first day, the first time I met him on the tour was walking down the hallway where all the dressing rooms were on that first stop, where all the trailers were, and saw his door open like a crack. And I looked in, I could see him sitting there. And last time we did this tour, because this is our second Soundwave, you're a Soundwave virgin, but I'm a veteran, been around the block a little bit with a Soundwave. And anyway, last time we were there, I really wanted to meet the singer of Monster Magnet, because he played in this old hardcore band, Shrapnel, power pop band Shrapnel. And so I met him, but I only met him once, and I got to talk to him about it. So I saw Duff, and I'm like, this might be my shot. So I went in there and just talked to him. You know, and he was so nice and so friendly. And he mentioned, yeah, I might be doing that podcast with Danko. And I'm like, I might be sitting in, though.
Yeah. And, I mean, I've met Duff, I think, 3 times before this Soundwave started, in various places all over the world, actually. And, every single time, very approachable. And you don't, you know, Guns N' Roses comes with so much, like, such a loaded
baggage.
Yeah. You really don't know like what you're going to get, but you know, reading It's So Easy, and I really recommend it out of all the books, which is a recent trend amongst, you know, 80s and 90s rock heroes and gods. I found his to be probably the best.
I think it's his most grounded in reality.
Yeah. Cause I loved like a lot of them go, yeah, I hit rock bottom and then I got back up. But they're just like a older version of how they were before.
They the really, exact same guy.
But there is really a real kind of climbing the mountain, a 90-degree turn that he did with his life that is like, it almost reads like a third act of a movie.
Yeah, it almost seems like he was on this trajectory, and then Guns N' Roses happened, and he had like some wilderness years, like what, 15, 10,
yeah.
10 15 wilderness years of you know, serious drugs and alcohol, serious alcohol mainly, but yeah, he emerges as this like, you know, totally different person and much better person from the sounds of it.
And, you know, just going through these flights with him and everything, you know, he has the respect and the ear and the attention of not just like fans or people, like every band on this tour, he has everyone. And he's so grounded and gracious, and I think we're like fawning over him.
Yeah, well, I think we kind of are
everyone's gonna hear us.
There are a lot of rock stars on this trip, like a lot of big name rock stars on this trip. And out of all the big name rock stars, he's definitely probably sold right up there with the most records, and he's always around. And you always can talk to him.
And he is on our stage. We all share the same stage. Fucked Up, Danko Jones, Duff McKagan.
Sword, Red Fang, Oh Brother.
Fozzie.
Fozzie,
the Deer Hunter.
No, Deer Hunter, they were on a stage for one night, but I don't think they still are.
Yeah, they were on yesterday.
They were on yesterday? Okay, yeah. The Deer Hunter.
You guys came late.
Yeah, well, because we didn't land till late. We've had the best schedule. We have, like, every day we're, like, in... Like, everywhere we're in till, like, the middle afternoon, they're like, hey, time to get your flight. We fly somewhere, you know, got days off on the beach.
Very chill.
We lucked out. Everyone's got different schedules, we should say, on this trip. Yeah. So.
So he's on our stage, stage 5, and I just realized, like, out of everybody on Soundwave, besides Metallica, Duff McKagan is the only person in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And he is the first person on this podcast who is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So this is a very, very special podcast.
But he's not the first person who's been in the Who's Emma Hall of Fame, because both Nick Flanagan and I are in the Who's Emma Hall of Fame.
This is true.
No, just kidding.
And Flanagan, again, is not here, and you have kind of taken his post.
Yeah, I've grown up my hair a little bit, wearing glasses.
So don't worry, Nick.
Yeah, don't worry, Nick. Yeah. Hey, Nick, guess what? I got to interview Duff. Go back to interviewing whoever you're going to interview from the CBC jobber. you got to leave that in.
Yeah, for sure. we, once again, like the Jericho podcast, we have to really kind of let everybody know that the audio isn't as clear as this because we were playing. We got Duff.
We should say how we had two attempts to get Duff, and you'll hear that in this. But the first one,
these are the Sidewave shows that it was us and Duff.
Yeah,
Danko Jones and Duff McKagan Loaded played our own shows together from the festival, and Damien was. It was awesome to hang out with you for the whole time.
Oh, super fun! It was. If it wasn't like because it was a really an awkward situation trying to get him because like we're both sitting here like. Journalist from a high school radio station with a microphone and the computer, and we're like waiting for him. And he's very, everyone wants a piece of him at a show like this, and he's getting a massage. And then, and it's.
We should say that everybody could get a massage.
Everyone's getting a massage. It wasn't like his masseuse was there. No, there was like a massage table. And so people took an advantage of it. I don't take advantage because I got hair everywhere. It just feels like someone pulling my hair.
Yeah, you got that. You got a hang up about that.
I got a weird thing about it. So I don't get massages, but some people did. Did you get one massage?
I always get a massage, but not on this tour.
You didn't get any on
tour? Well, I've been slammed with all this podcasting. That's so true. Which is one of the reasons why we were really, this podcast is in two parts.
Yeah, it had to be in two parts because we got them for 15 minutes the first go around before you were, we'll get to that.
Yeah, it's all on tape, and we've just decided to leave it all in there so everybody knows exactly the circumstances and the environment that we were left up to grab... Probably the biggest person that's been on this podcast.
Yeah.
And we're left to the fates of a club show.
And certainly the person that's had, the biggest impact on both of our lives musically. Like, not that other people haven't had impacts, but, here's someone that, like, Guns N' Roses, whether you're reacting against them or reacting to them, you're still reacting.
And I got to say, when you listen to this podcast, Damien Abraham manages to make Guns N' Roses sound like Duff McKagan's side project. And you just go right into, you're going to hear it all. But I enjoyed it. For everybody out there who fancies themselves a Guns N' Roses fan, it is a little bit of a music lesson courtesy of Damien Abraham. And I was watching Duff's face while you were just like shooting all these names out at him. And he was very impressed.
Well, I think the
funny, and very surprised.
Well, thank you. But I think the funny thing about these guys is they don't realize the impact these other bands they had have had. I think they, because they kind of became bigger than that, And I'm not blaming them for that. Guns N' Roses is huge, and have influenced millions and millions and millions of people. But the fact is, the Farts, the Fastbacks, the Silly Killers, the Living, the Veins, 10-Minute Warning, all those bands have influenced, thousands of people. But those thousands of people have also influenced thousands of people. And it's like, I met a dude who has a Farts back piece. I'm like, I got to show Duff McKagan that because he doesn't believe that people like the band that much, right. And I think it's, it's always fun when you get to meet these people and you're like, what about this band? And they're like, really, you like that? I was 15. It's like, yeah, but that's so perfect. Like, you made something so perfect at 15 that it still resonates today.
I did that. I had a moment like that, and I called it, I pulled a Damien Abraham. So we were hanging out. This is not nothing to do with the Duff McKagan podcast, which is you were about to listen to, but I think
I love these intros when you listen to a podcast. I love when, you know,
like a super huge tangent like that
to,
I'm about
it's
to.
It's like going to the movie and get a trailer. You know, the trailer's part of the best fucking part of going to the movie. You miss the trailer, don't even go to the movie. Yeah. Don't just sit home. You legally downloaded then.
So we were all hanging out, and it was the end of the day, and everybody was going to head off to the airport, and all the bands were going to fly to Perth. And we were sitting down, and there's this guy, and he's very low-key. He's just got a T-shirt on, jeans, and he's got a ponytail. And I'm staring at him. I'm like, I know who this guy is. I just can't focus in enough, concentrate, and make that recognition. Yeah. And then I did, and it was Eric Singer from Kiss.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was just there. He was just standing there, and because Kiss are about to play Australia next week with Motley Crue.
Yeah.
So I guess they're here early for rehearsals, etc. And because everybody knows I'm the biggest Kiss fan, and when everything came into focus and I stayed on target and I'm supposed to destroy the Death Star, I just go, oh my God, that's Eric Singer from Kiss. And I walked up and I walked straight, and as I was going, I realized earlier that day during our show, there was a guy with a Badlands T-shirt, and I pointed him out. Badlands was Eric's old band, even before pre-Kiss. So I pulled it, and then I came back and I hit it off with him with the Badlands. I threw him the Badlands thing. I threw him a bunch of other things, and then I just walked back to our group and I go, I think I just pulled a Damien. It worked, man. I got Eric's undivided attention.
Because, like, then you also would, like, you know, not saying that you should do this because it's a way to get in with these people or anything like that, but also you figure these people talk about their, like, he talks about Kiss.
Yeah.
99% of the time, you know, like, when we went on tour with the Foo Fighters, like, talking to Nate, like, I brought up Brotherhood. He's like, no one has ever brought up that band to me, ever. And, like, no one brings up these old bands to these people. And, like, that is, like, a place of innocence and a place of fun for them and music discovery. Like, that's, you know, most of the time when the people are talking about that music period, that's when they got into the music. That's when they're most excited about it. And so, yeah, getting to talk to them about it. And it's also being from punk and hardcore, being from, like, old metal, like, you know, you and I are in our respective ways. It's like you get those ins with these people because you're from, like, you're like, you know, this sounds really horrible to say it, but I'm going to fucking say it because that's how I feel. But, like, it shows that, like, I'm not like these other people. I'm down. And, like, yeah, you can go too far and nerd the person out and they can be sick of you really quickly. But, you know, at least you have that moment to show them that you're down.
Well, if you're going to do it to somebody who will understand where you're coming from, I think Duff McKagan is the perfect person to lay all that stuff on. And I think he's quite amused.
I was worried I was going to start crying. Like, your music meant so much to me.
Well, here it is. This is Duff McKagan.
Part one.
And then you'll hear why there had to be a part two. But part two is included in this episode. And it's me and Damien Abraham and Duff McKagan on the official Danko Jones podcast. And it starts now. And with that intro, we have on the podcast Mr. Duff McKagan from Loaded, Velvet Revolver, and of course Guns N' Roses.
You want me to drop the signs now, buddy?
Well,
the Fastbacks, and the Farts, and the Silly Killers, and 10-minute warning.
That's why I brought
Damien
Abraham here. Is taking over from Nick Flanagan for the Soundwave podcast. And we're playing a show with Loaded today. So we've been playing together, our three bands, one after the other, for Soundwave. We asked Duff, and I asked you, Damien, and Duff's here, and I'm really fucking happy that you're here on the podcast.
Oh, yeah. Good.
We're about to go on stage, too, so it's like...
Right.
I'm doing five things at once, and I'm happy to do all of them.
Yeah.
So We read your book and stuff.
Yeah, we both read
and
your book.
Listened to your records and shit. All
right.
Yeah, it's like it's one of those weird things where getting to talk to you, it's like very rarely are you given the, you know, like as fans of your bands and stuff, like you're very rarely given the opportunity to kind of say like thank you, because like I don't know what I'd be into if it wasn't for the music you made, you know, like I don't know where I would have gone, and I really am appreciative because I have a really easy job now because I play in a band, so you know.
Yeah, that sound you guys hear right now.
Yeah,
this is stop talking. That's the sound of freedom.
That's the coffee being made.
That's coffee being ground.
Oh, okay. Because you're looking for coffee. All right. Yeah.
That's the sound of America, right?
That
there.
Is the sound of America. That's the... Well, actually, I hear isn't coffee better here than in America, I hear? Oh, you're from Seattle, though. That's like a matter of... That's fighting words there, right?
Kind
of
is.
Okay,
yeah.
I apologize.
Yeah.
I don't drink it. Never got into it.
Yeah, but we're raised like our mother's breast milk has espresso.
Espresso.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, you come by it naturally and stuff.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah. So all that punk rock scene in Seattle...
Oh, it's coffee culture.
Well, you know, like you were saying, you and I were talking the other day that like every band in 79, 80, 81, 82, the early 80s in Seattle were also different. We were just all caffeinated. We couldn't concentrate on one thing like they could in Washington, D.C. And
focus on, yeah, well, yeah. I guess Black Flag, you know, it's, you know, Rollins, it's black coffee. It's like, it's a real, Descendants have the song, Coffee Mug. You know, there's a real kind of current in, you know, you need to be caffeinated if you're doing it all yourself. You know, you can't really afford to do it all yourself when you're, well, that being said, there's not punks getting wasted too. I was going to say, see, that's why everyone just drinks coffee, but no, there's people that do other things.
Yeah, there's
too.
A lot of other things going around.
But like, you know, not to dominate
no,
conversation,
Dane,
but
that's why I brought you on here, man, for some punk rock cred with Duff.
In
man.
The book, you talk about like the incident where you guys got in that scrap with Nirvana backstage of the MTV Awards, mm-hmm. and then you talk about like Kim from the Fastbacks calling you the next day and kind of reaming you out.
Yeah.
And I think that's like a really interesting thing that like you're like the two biggest bands of the era coming from the same point. You know, like you guys are from the exact same scene, and you know, and it's like, as a kid growing up, I never liked any glam or metal stuff except GNR, and it was always like, why do I like it? Because it's like Guns N' Roses was a punk band at the end of the day, you know, like kind of continuing that. Was that like something you thought at the time, or were you like, I don't feel part of that scene at all anymore?
Well, I mean, to go back to like the beginning of Guns. When I moved to LA from Seattle, it was 84. A bunch of drugs had just come into Seattle. They'd come in like 2 years mm-hmm. prior, like 82, and there was a recession going on, and there was no places to play in Seattle anymore. And I was 19. It was like either time to go somewhere.
Yeah, because you moved just before that whole like sub pop kind of noise rock type thing. 88, right? That's kind of gets going.
Well, the interesting thing is Bruce Pavitt and I worked at the same restaurant.
So oh, really?
As I was, we were working the kitchen together. So he had just put out his first sub pop single, and I left. But
was that like Green River or is that Tad?
What was the first single?
I think it's Green River.
I want to say it was like something like Section 8.
Oh, you know what? No, it was a comp. Didn't he do the Sub Pop 100 comp? Because he was doing those tape comps before that. And I think the first album they did was Sub Pop 100.
We'll have to get back. No, it was a single.
It was a single. Okay. We'll have to nerd out.
It was his first piece of vinyl because he was doing those cassettes.
Yeah. For years, like the underground Sub Pop underground compilations or something, right?
Yeah. So, to me, moving to LA and Guns starting, I mean, it was really 84. If you were in that sort of wave of punk rock that I was got to be a part of, wasn't really the first wave. It wasn't the English or the Ramones.
No, but that's the wave where it gets interesting. That's the wave where people act. The kids are actually doing it themselves.
We interpreted.
Yeah, exactly.
The Damned and the Pistols and things. Richard Hell and. Into something else, mm-hmm. and then Black Flag was going to deal. We had DOA and the Germs, of course. I mean, that really changed. That was a game changer.
Yeah.
That Joan Jett produced record was like the sonic, you know, real drum, real guitar, for an American band.
Yeah.
That was a big deal. But then, like the also influences through Kim through the Seattle. thing was different in that we didn't know any different. Like, we weren't biased against listening to Sweet and
well, the Slade, Runaways probably, and
like, the Runaways.
So you guys didn't have that whole, because back in like the mid '80s, punk and metal or punk and rock, and there was, it's not, people don't realize that the dividing lines that divided punk and other factions like metal and rock were very, very thick and strong. And I saw, I see you as someone who were one of the first people who did the crossover thing. Being in Guns and having that punk rock background, people didn't realize, like, now they don't realize how strong those dividing lines are.
Yeah, did you think it was maybe because you didn't have to, you left before you had to pick a side? Before you had to be a metalhead or a punk, you could still be into, you know.
No, I definitely went to gigs on the east side from Seattle.
Yeah, the west side was the metal side or something?
No, the east side.
Oh, it was a metal side?
So I was from Seattle proper. And so there wasn't really any metal. Mike McCready had a band called Shadow. But he hung out with punkers. He didn't really understand punk, but he had this band Shadow. But there was bands like Culprit and...
there's like huge metal band from there too, like not Virgin Killer or something, like, but like one of the big...
Queensryche?
Maybe Queensryche, that's what they are.
Virgin Killer from Queensryche?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I was grasping at metal straws. I like punk.
But the Farts played a show with...
Oh, and I guess Culprit. The Accused and stuff were like kind of... They were one of the first crossover bands too, right?
Yeah, Accused were. Yeah, totally.
We went over to the east side and played a show with a metal band, and we were the only punkers there, and it was one of those things where, you know, people wanted to kick our ass because we were punk rock faggots and all that stuff.
Okay.
But, so I know I totally experienced that divide.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really silly. And if you're from Seattle, you just thought the whole thing was silly because we loved AC. We loved good metal.
Yeah.
You know, whatever metal really was.
Like Motorhead, AC/DC, like...
Yeah. Tank.
Tank, Venom.
Girl School and...
like New Wave of...
Judas Priest?
New Wave of British Heavy Metal stuff.
Yeah, that stuff.
Yeah.
But did you feel any time when you're in, like, Guns and stuff that you had to, like, kind of wear that punk rock banner on your sleeve a little bit just to remind some people who kind of... Because of those dividing lines?
You know, when you're young... So Guns started, and the first gigs that we played, that we opened for Dickies, Social Distortion, Tex and the Horseheads... Fear.
How'd you go over at those shows? Because because that's what I would have thought. Like, that L.A. seems like, you know, as much as there was probably a divide in L.A.
That wasn't in that faded first tour that you talk about where you play with the Fastbacks.
So just after that.
Oh, okay.
So we played with the Fastbacks. That was our first proper show up in Seattle.
Yeah.
We sucked. But it was a punk rock band, but it was 85. So punk rock... Back to if you come from where I come from, it was over. Punk rock was dead. The kids from the suburbs would come in, shaved their heads, were doing the Nazi thing, hardcore. They didn't know the spirit of punk rock was gone. It was all beat the crap out of somebody there, and they thought pogo dancing or slam dancing was fighting.
Yeah.
So it was this whole turning where it got pretty ugly. So
did they have bands? Like, what were the that scene's? Like, not to talk shit, obviously,
really,
but, like,
know.
I'm just wondering what they would... Were they, like, just, like, kids that would come up with the Circle Jerks came to town? Like, the big kind of touring band? Because you hear those stories about the Circle Jerks, and, like, they would show up, and they'd have the people that would come just for them, and they would fuck everyone up.
Yeah, that kind of stuff happened all the time.
Yeah.
And I stopped going to show. I'm like, this isn't what I... It's not what it's about. So, 84, you were trying to, like... We knew we were going to be the next, whatever was going to be the thing, was kind of on our shoulders. Who knows what it was going to be? Hanoi Rocks was like this punk band that played with the Damned and all.
Well, they started. Briard was their first band. Fuck the Army is like the singer of Hanoi Rocks' first band, and they did three amazing punk singles.
There you go.
I got him here.
No, but that, absolutely, that's what you're saying, because I think punk is like one of those rare times where you have like a paradigm shift, a cultural shift where. Almost like everything that kind of comes out after that's cool has some sort of weird root to it in some way. Like all over the world, like be it Japan, like with Gizum and Gaza
and Black Flag. Black Flag was in this weird flux thing with, that Kira had just come in, and there was no real solid thing. Razzle, drummer from Hanoi, died. I had tickets to that gig at the Palace thing. I was going with Slash. Our band had just started, and Hanoi was like, "Let's go." We got tickets, and he died right before the gig at the Palace in the car crash.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
So they were. That was it. And but we weren't trying to be like Hanoi Rocks. Yeah. Not saying that, but that was kind of like maybe that's the new energy of what this thing is. Like cool guitar player plays like Thunders.
Yeah.
Kind of little Keith, and like these guys are weird and write great fucking songs. I mean, they wrote great songs.
Yeah. Oh yeah, unbelievable.
Like, how do these guys write songs like this?
Well, you know, Michael Monroe's still going strong.
He's going very strong. No.
He's on tour, I think, with Slash right now.
Is he?
Yeah.
No, Slash.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's the old, swing.
No, I'm friends with Dragon, so I'm on.
Oh, Facebook Dragon's great.
Uploads those photos of him hanging out with Michael Monroe and all that stuff. So.
Yeah, Michael's going very strong, right? Yeah.
He's going, and I just saw him like 2 years ago, and he comes on stage like all the other guys are younger than him. He looks younger than them. He's just doing the high kicks like it's 1986 or something.
He's insane. He's a freak in nature, that guy. Really is. Like, you're right. He has
and
more...
the nicest guy, too.
Totally. Yeah. I saw him at the Whiskey last year, and same thing. Like, he climbed the pole up to the balcony. Yeah. Like, you're hanging from one arm. Dude, I know you're older than me. You got to be 52 or something. And it doesn't matter. That guy's just ageless. And, but,
We played Eskina with him, and he came to the festival with a broken leg. The cast was on his leg, and then when they went on stage, it was Hanoi Rocks. It wasn't his own solo.
Oh, right.
And he was climbing the scaffolding, and he ran through the crowd and everything with his broken leg. And I was complaining that, you know, like, I didn't stretch my hand enough, and my hand was cramping when I was playing guitar that day.
See, but that guy's real. Like, you know, it is real. It's not a put-on. It's real. He's that guy. I mean, and he came from that school of, you know, Iggy and...
Yeah,
you know,
it was a totally, punk, is it? Yeah. All right.
That's can like, we go on?
Yeah.
10-minute warning.
I feel
boom,
100.
You like that?
I feel honored that we're doing a podcast 10 minutes before you go on stage to play.
Can we do this again the next side wave?
Like let's do it again the next side wave.
And do part two?
Yeah.
Is that I'm, cool
I'm,
with
you? I have a day off.
Did we even cover anything?
Well, I'm this is like this is awesome for me because I'm this is what I'm interested in, the transition,
his
you know.
Punk rock nut with his, like all the fucking
no, believe me, I got way more shit to get into. Right.
Okay.
He's telling me like, "Oh, I'm going to ask stuff this and that."
Oh, we haven't even begun.
Oh my god. Oh my god.
Okay, part two.
I heard coffee. Okay, part two.
Yeah, so that had to end right away.
Yep.
Because I had to play.
You had to go rock the house and nail of the park performing with Duff, too.
Yeah, I played after we did that like small little podcast, half a podcast with Duff. Went on stage, played, got off stage, did the Jericho podcast.
Oh, that's right. We did everybody's the Jericho heard.
Podcast. Yeah.
Sorry, and I totally forgot that. We did that right after.
The thing is, and now you can hear on both sides of this podcast and the Jericho co-podcast, I'm doing three things at once. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get into the show that I'm about to play or the song I'm about to sing with Duff, watch the sound waves on my laptop, hold the mic properly, proper mic placement, and at the end, try to engage myself with what you got going on with either Chris or Duff. So there's a lot of things going in my head, and I might sound very quiet, but that's only because I got three, four things going through my head.
When also you were dealing with a very loud, overzealous punk fan who was taking up a lot of time rambling on.
But I didn't mind that. It was more the coffee machine and the reverberation from downstairs. So, and plus the fact that, well, I usually do a warm up, and for both times, both sides of this podcast, I was unable to do, and you could hear it in my voice. My voice is shot to hell on these podcasts. I don't know if you can hear it now. I've been able to recover since then, but you can really hear it on the podcast. So I'm not trying to make any excuses. The excuse is in my voice.
But I think that also reflects how honest the situation, these podcasts came out. And it's not like someone coming over your house. This is like in work. Everyone's at work doing their thing. And then also finding time to do a podcast.
But the second time we sat down with Duff, which you're about to hear, better circumstances. Yeah. We had more of his attention.
Oh, absolutely.
And even though still not the best room to do a podcast.
Well, you hear a lot of people come in at various points. But what's going on here? Oh, sorry. Yeah. And one thing I'll say about Duff is he never broke focus on talking to us. He was like not interested in what these people were going to try and interrupt for.
Oh, man. He rules.
He rules. Rules. Super cool dude. And I definitely showed him that. There are a lot of people nerdy about his old bands.
Here we go. So we're part two of the Duff McKagan podcast. We're here. The first one was in Sydney. The second part is in Melbourne. How you doing, Duff?
Good. We magically just transported from Sydney to Melbourne.
I need a break to charge my recharge my nerd battery. So we had to stop it last time, so I can now get more nerdy facts for you.
Yeah, we listened to the first part, and man, Damien, you came out of the gate with all
this. I just dropped some nerd stuff, but I feel bad because I'm embarrassed because I didn't bring up the Veins, and there's a band from Toronto named after a Vein song, the School Jerks.
They're named after?
Yep.
I did not know that.
No, it's crazy. It's like, we kind of touched on it a little bit, but like, you know, obviously you had an insane impact in the band, you know, the huge bands that you've been in, but it's like every single small band you were into has also had a massive impact.
It's weird.
It's weird. Just
I appreciate that. I don't really, now that you tell me there's a band called the School Jerks.
they will be stoked to hear you say that.
But, you know, it was I'm really just lucky to be kind of born the year I was born and to have been in, you know, around a good punk rock scene when I was 13 and 14 and a unique punk rock scene in Seattle and listening to all the music, the influences I had through Kim and Kurt from the Fastbacks and turning me on to whatever and being able to play like one of the first hardcore bands.
Yeah.
Before we even called it hardcore, I believe.
Yeah, guess what? Hardcore 81 DOA puts
there.
Out.
I was there.
Oh, you read that show?
I was there.
Oh, that's unbelievable. Yeah. Like, that's the titular hardcore record, right?
So,
Canada, we're very, we know every single possible Canadian thing, as you probably know from Canadians, and we definitely lay claim to that hardcore titular record, Hardcore 81.
Yeah, that was kind of the first time, hardcore, like, but it was, I mean, Canada, like, DOA hardcore was a good hardcore.
Yeah,
okay, you want to go with hardcore, you want to call it hardcore, you call it anything you want, you're DOA. But I used to go up to Vancouver, we would go up every weekend. You could drink, you know, then you get across the border, we were 16, 15, and we would forge, all you needed was a parent's note. So we would just forge a parent's note, and that's all you needed. There's no.
So there was like a super tight relationship between like the Subhumans, DOA, and Point and Sticks, and Vancouver,
we would stay at the DOA house.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was a house on Georgia, off Georgia Street.
Because I know you eventually, like Ron Reyes, he's in the road crew for like, he tries out for the road crew or something. Like,
no, God.
That's like a legendary, I think maybe in your book or maybe in another interview.
Did he come down? Well, him and I were hanging out pretty tight that when I first moved to L.A.
Did you know him? Because he lived in Vancouver for a long time, right? Like, did you know him in Vancouver back then?
Well, the first gig I ever played was with the Veins, and we opened for Black Flag in Seattle when Ron was singing. So it was 79.
I think that's a tour when he leaves, when they get to Vancouver, right?
Maybe.
And then they come back and Dez becomes the singer.
There was some trouble. There was some trouble following Ron. And I think he just stayed in Vancouver. I don't want to.
No.
He stayed in Vancouver.
So did you know him? You probably met him up in Vancouver, like having played with him and then hanging out with him in Vancouver. And
I met him when we opened for him in Seattle.
Yeah.
And then, him being up in Vancouver, he lived with this guy, Dale, who had a record store in Vancouver, and they lived on Hastings.
What record store was that? Was that Zulu or something?
No, I knew you were going to ask me that. Yeah, right? Yeah. It was a famous one. I can never remember the name of it. Quintessence.
Oh, Quintessence. Okay, yeah. Yeah, who put out, like, you know, all the Subhuman stuff, yeah. Point and Stick stuff, yeah. Too. Modernettes and
yep.
Whatnot.
Yeah. So oh. Dale.
Okay.
And Ron lived there, and Ron started like screen printing and stuff, and we would stay there or the DOA house. So at the it's like 110 Hastings was their address.
So
how I remember that? No idea.
We should go there now and see who's there now.
Yeah.
They just broke DOA's retiring this year. This is like their last.
I didn't get to see one of those gigs.
I think yeah. They might still be doing another West Coast swing too. In the near future. So, yeah, I mean, I saw them in Toronto on the last tour and stuff. And it was like, you know, like here's a band that, you know, every band should kind of be grateful to. Like yeah. Every, because they kind of set up that tour route, them and yeah. Black Flag. And it's like.
How many people were there?
It was actually pretty well attended. I'm not going to pretend it was like no one there. But I've seen right. Definitely seen DOA shows that have been under attended, to say the least. But it's just, you know, it's funny that we go through this indie rock boom and. It all kind of comes back
from DOA. It really did. DOA was before. I mean, I saw it. I really did. And I saw the phone list.
No, they're the master list.
Yeah, they had the master list of phone numbers to call of clubs and every clubs, quote unquote. Yeah. I'm
show spaces.
Yeah, whether it's basements of houses yeah. or clubs. There was, you know, and the crash pad, you know, home numbers, mm-hmm. Of course. Mm-hmm. And you would get, like, if you were booking a tour, and Des reminded me of this recently, because remember we used to get the credit card numbers for phone, for calling, and you'd go to the payphone, and you would use this stolen credit card
number to put in, yeah.
Like a phone credit card.
Yeah,
number.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I've totally forgotten about that. And you would call, and you would book a tour.
You know what's crazy? Because, like, both Danko and I'm sure when you guys started, you had that list. I know with Fucked Up, we definitely had that list where we had a list of numbers and names for every city, mm-hmm. and you knew, like, and someone would be like, "Hey, I want to play this place. Do you have a number?" And you're like, "Yeah, this kid does shows." And
JC had that.
Yeah, list. Missoula, you know, and you're like, "Okay, well, let's call this kid
yeah.
and get a show there and stuff." And it's funny because like that ritual of getting those numbers, getting that list, you know, survived right up till, you know, I guess the advent of the internet kind of made, you know, why would you need that list anymore? You just Google.
I don't know anymore. I don't know. Yeah. There was a period of time where we just started going on tour, and you know, it just takes over. Mm-hmm. I don't really. When we first started out, it was like going to the club, meeting a band you really like, getting their phone number, going to their space. We did that with Ian Savonius in the makeup.
Yeah.
And then they brought us down to DC, and then we brought them to Toronto.
Bring them to Toronto.
And,
yeah. Yeah.
And then I met all these people from the DC scene, and. It was going strong, and then, I don't know, we just got hooked into the whole infrastructure that, you know, people like DOA already set up, and away we went.
So that must have been, like, a huge mindfuck, though, to go from, like, that world to be, you know, was it, like, 5 years later, 6 years later in Guns, and, like, in the other side of touring, where, like, it freaks me out to sometimes be out of the little DIY world I'm in, and I'm only one step removed, but to go from, like, you know, collecting numbers, making sure you can get from city to city, to like obviously Guns did that too, but then to be in the biggest band in the world, like that must
well,
have been a head
trip. Well, it took a while to be that yeah. big band. We, but I do remember the first time we got a tour bus, and it was the crew and the band, but we were on a tour bus. We picked it up in Toronto. We went on our first tour, big tour, was opening for the Cult in '87.
Oh, I remember that.
Summer of '87, going mm-hmm. across Canada, starting Nova Scotia. Halifax,
Newfoundland. Oh, Halifax.
I was working at a fish and chips shop at the CNE, and I heard you guys playing.
With the Cult.
I was cutting up fish at the CNE, and you guys opened up for the Cult.
Yeah.
And in your book, you said that like nobody really paid attention. I was at a record store the next day, and I saw people looking for Appetite for Destruction.
The next day.
Yeah, the next day. It was really like... You guys just came out. I don't know. Maybe it was just me and the circumstances that I was in. But for me, my idea of Guns N' Roses is like you just guys came out with a like a bang, like literally overnight. I saw a little square. There was you were on the cover of Hit Parader with three other bands. And it was kind of like the future of rock and roll. And the other
what were the other two bands?
I think one of them was Striper.
Future, right there. That was the Future.
And then it was like you guys, and then you guys just kept those guys, those bands, kind of, you know.
Yeah, it's funny that
went
whole,
and you guys just
the whole Hit Parader and thing was a real strain. That was.
And like, Rip magazine too.
Yeah, Rip was a little cooler. Like they came out a couple of years later, but Hit Parader was. I mean, it was cool to be in Hit Parader.
But like as a punk dude, were you like?
That's what I want to know. Is like, how are you bridging these two worlds? Especially at the time it was you know 85 to 87. How are you bridging that in your head?
To me, really, I mean, I think I've said it before and enough times. I just. Like sometime in 83, like the punk rock that I knew was gone. It was just, it was gone. And it, I was mourning that, like that fun and that inventiveness. And it was all just kind of punk by numbers, hardcore, you know, what did they vote? And the kids coming in from the suburbs and shaving their heads and fighting, mm-hmm. you know, and they're, you know, putting the Nazi hand up and, I'm like, this...
Not my scene.
Well, that's an easy scene to get out of.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was... I'm done with that. You know, I would go, still go see my band. Like, but anything that was associated closely... remotely associated with hardcore. Hardcore 81 was different. That was in 81.
Yeah, yeah.
But by 83, was just a... So they, these kids would come to the shows and all up and down the West Coast. And it just... This, for me, ruined it. You know? And... So by 80, it wasn't like I was, I just knew there was a sea change, even like Ron Reyes in Hollywood with me in 84, he had this band called Crash Bang Crunch Pop, just weird, like, I want to be like Sweet and Hanoi Rocks, you know, or, and Prince. Cool. That's, you can do it. You can do whatever you want because we were just trying to invent something. Everybody was, who was like, I guess around my age, was 19 or 20, been playing in bands for long, you know, 5 years is a long time when you're 19.
Yeah.
That's a quarter of your life. You've been touring and doing stuff. You're a veteran. So whatever's next is on your shoulders and whatever that was. And then I just happened to, you know, meet Slash through an ad in the paper. And he was this dark, weird dude from Hollywood and hung out at Starwood and seen Fear, but he had long hair and played like a blues guy. Like, this is fucking cool, you know? And Izzy moved in across the street from me, and he's this guy from Indiana, and punk rock, played in the Naughty Women, played drums for the Naughty Women. You know, he was down at the, what's that? Pat Brown, what's that club down there? Huntington Beach.
In Huntington Beach,
he was there the night of the riot, the thing happened.
The Black Flag riot?
Yes.
Yeah, the, what riot is that?
Oh, Bat Brown. You know what song I'm talking about.
And I'm trying to remember the name of the club, though.
But he was there, you know, so he hung out in that, and he was this cool, like, Keith Richards-looking dude, and things just really happened, and Axl was his buddy, and Axl was, he was the real deal. More punk rock than anybody trying to be punk rock. Because it was real.
Yeah.
And it was...
like a real marginal... like that's what he needed to be type thing.
Yeah. I mean, that was him. And it
like
was...
like Danger Incarnate kind of?
Yeah. And it was, you know, more punk rock than punk. And it was more metal, I guess, than what I knew metal to be. It was just like kind of everything. And
what were your friends like, though? Like, because that's... you know, once again, not to bring it back to me. But I remember, like, even when my band started getting written up in, like... you know, mainstream music magazines, like some of my friends that were like, fuck your band now, fuck you guys. Was it like, were you like, because Guns was like a punk band still, but like, were there people back in Seattle like hating on it? Or was it all like being like, dude, you guys?
No, I think because we kind of bridged that gap just perfectly, because there was kind of one of everybody in the band. Nobody's trying to get mainstream press by any means. And the band was genuine.
Mm-hmm.
So when we played on that tour, the cult tour, and we came through Seattle, we played the Paramount. And I mean, everybody that was kind of anybody in Seattle, you know, the Soundgarden guys and the Green River guys and Andy Wood, and everybody came to the gig because we were like, I was one of them.
You're like the hometown guy coming back.
Yeah, I was one of them. Yeah. And they were all, you know, Mother Love Bone was starting up, and they wanted to be, I mean, Andy wanted to be the
biggest rock
queen, you know? So, and he was a malfunction.
Yeah.
I think it just kind of made, at the time it made sense. No, I didn't get shit, you know, like, one, like going to the East Village or something in New York, you know, some skinhead dude.
Yeah, fucks with
you. Fuck you, yeah. Rocker faggot. You know, like,
it was weird at that point being like, I'm
bless you, child. You know not what you
said. Exactly. Like, are you like, dude, I saw all the bands you have written on your jacket. Like, I was there at those shows. Like, is it weird being like in that position where you're like, dude, I've paid all those fucking dues. We are not the same as these other bands that we're getting lumped in with. So that's the thing, like, Guns kind of got lumped in.
Yeah, they did. That's why I brought up the Hit Parader
coming. Yeah. And you guys weren't that band.
You weren't like Striper or anything like that. It was one listen and you could easily tell.
But we believed in ourselves, so we didn't really even care about what anybody said about us. What magazine we ended up in. We were just doing our thing. We were in this little bubble doing our thing. And really probably ignorant to a lot of the stuff that was even being said or magazines we were in. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have a collection at home of, I didn't keep every magazine and collect it.
Just my mom threw mine out, I would have.
And it's also pre-Twitter where people like, be like, hey, did you read this terrible review about you?
Yeah.
Send.
Right. Yeah. You'd be gone by the time
that would come out. Yeah.
It would come out in a paper.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Right? So it was just you kind of had to be there, but I've never had a real urge to explain myself, like, to punkers or mm-hmm. to anybody, mm-hmm. even to this day. Like, it's funny talking to you. You're like, dude, Fast Packs and Veins, and like, yeah, you know, people do get it. History does have a tendency to straighten things out.
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, and you see that now because you're seeing, you know, you're seeing like the children that grew up finding these records, starting bands, you know, and you're seeing like that happens. You know, and it's part of the natural process, like being a Guns N' Roses fan, being and someone being at a record store, being like, "Yo, check out this Farts record. This is the dude from GNR's band." And you're like, "What the fuck?" And then you go back and kind of follow those threads. Mm-hmm. And I guess as more and more people are doing that, you know, you get a better picture kind of emerging of, you know, like I knew you were a punk band as a fan, Guns N' Roses, because of the songs you were covering, like, you know, doing like Fear songs or something like that. Like, I knew it was like there's a punk thing there, you know, Dead Boy songs or Rocket from the Tomb songs, as the case may be.
Yeah.
You did a Rocket from the Tomb song?
Well, yeah, Ain't It Fun was originally a Rocket from the Tomb song. Peter Lofner wrote it before Dead Boys covered it.
Oh, wow.
And stuff. And
very cool.
Yeah.
And but so, like, I knew that, but it's like then kind of like falling back, and then you realize, like, you know, you fall back the thread from the Beastie Boys, you know, and you're like, oh, they were in a hardcore band too. And you fall back, you're like, oh, I love Down by Law, the movie. And you're like, Jim Jarmusch was in a punk band, you know, and you kind of follow it back and you realize, like, this kind of cultural explosion that kind of continuously keeps happening, keeps drawing, like, Danko, myself, like, that's how we kind of know each other, through punk rock.
Right.
You know, and like him coming and singing with this hardcore band that my band opened for years ago. That's the first time I met him and stuff, like, being a fan of his band, obviously. And it's like,
I don't know.
You just kind of, you did a Black Flag cover, you did a Youth of Today cover, a Minor Threat cover.
No, I don't remember meeting you, remember?
Oh, yeah, no, but don't worry. I was much fatter and much hair on my head and no beard back then. So, but, like, you do realize, like, it was like a wave. And, like, are you still shocked when you run into people and you're like, you know the Farts, you know all these bands? Or is it just something where you, like, you're like, I know that stuff. Like, are you aware of how big those bands are to, like, this underground scene?
No.
Yeah, it's so weird. Like, and you're not obviously the first person I've encountered that I've brought up their old band and just being, like, nerdy about it. But it's crazy. Like, you go to Japan and I'm seeing the Veins record on the wall for $500 and stuff. And you're going to, like, you know, and you just.
Did you know that?
No.
I don't even want to tell you about some of the prices that I've seen. Some
I know that Silly Killer single, somebody, Mike McCready, saw it for like 200. I think he bought it. Saw it for like 250 bucks.
If I found that for 250 bucks, I would definitely pay for it. I think it's more like a $400 record.
Didn't you already buy something for 200 bucks today?
I bought, you know the Australian X? Like, not the.
There was an Australian
X? Yeah, they were like much more. Actually,
very U-Men, Seattle sound. AMREP ends up reissuing their record at one point, Amphetamine Reptile. But they were like 79 in here and just like really damaged, and I paid
$200. Not the Dutch, the X.
Not the X. The
LAX.
Not the LAX.
Japanese X.
Oh.
Japanese X.
Whoa, someone just dropped some science on me. Is it Japanese?
X Japan would do like 5 nights at the Tokyo Dome.
Holy jeez.
We got to Japan. I remember the first time there's a band called X here. There's a band called X in LA. No, this band X is huge. They do Tokyo Dome 5 nights. Tokyo Dome.
Holy Jesus.
Yeah. So there was X Japan.
Were they like a glammy band or a pop band or
pop?
Rock, I guess. Yeah. But J Rock, you know.
J Rock. Oh, yeah, J Rock. Yeah. It's weird because like you go to Japan and like obviously, you know, there's huge scenes for every type of music there, and then you find out that import music only makes up 20% of the music market. It's like 80% domestic music.
Yeah, you know, Marty Friedman, who used to be in Megadeth, he lives in Japan now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was telling me, yeah, I gotta prepare. I gotta play Budokan next month, and he's all in that whole J-rock scene, and he's done 300 television show appearances. Wow. Playing in
it's bands. Like a, just like in the band.
Yeah, just doing music stuff. He lives in Tokyo now.
There was a guy I met, you know, when Loaded first went to Japan in 2001, and this guy, I got this invitation from this guy named Jay, and he was in a band called Lunacy. Never heard of him. And somebody said, oh, they're huge in Japan. And this Jay, I met him, and he had blonde hair, and he plays bass, and he had like, and somebody said, yeah, you're his like
idol
thing. And he has a white bass and thing. And I met him, and we ended up playing shows with Jay. Like his solo band was huge. And he invited us to come. We played like an arena tour of Japan. It was awesome.
Wow.
But that was my first intro into real, like that J-pop.
J-pop, that's what it's called. J-pop. What was I calling it? J-rock?
Well, I call it J-rock because they were more rock. X-Japan was more rock.
Oh, okay.
But I guess it was J-pop.
J-pop. Yeah, that's what it is.
That's crazy. Well, that must be surreal to like look out and be like, there's a dude
who's doing me.
And you know, I was really old. So I was, how old was I? I was like 36 or 35.
Yeah.
I wasn't 60.
Yeah, you know? Didn't feel like, it's not like Elvis.
And he's like talking to the crowd. There, you know, we had an interpreter. He's telling them about you now. You know? And they're like, so the word spread, like, you know, and people would show up for us to play because it's a, like, I'm a 35-year-old fucking Elvis, right? This point, you know? But it's pretty funny.
What's the weirdest place you've played? Like, you've probably played everywhere now, right?
No.
You never did Russia or anything? No, really?
Never done
Russia. Yeah. VR didn't do Russia back in...
Yeah.
Guns, we...
Well, if your VR would have done it by now, no? Or then?
No. We played something called Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
You know, when the wall first went down. So we played Prague. We were the first band to play Prague. And that was...
Pretty heavy, I imagine.
Really amazing.
Yeah.
And played in Hungary and played... in Germany, like East Germany. Like,
have you gone back to these places now and like loaded in VR?
Yeah, a ton of times.
Do you see like, you probably see like
the change,
but it must have been a shocking change being like the first rock band behind those places and now going back and seeing like the rock scenes that's really developed. Like some of these places have bigger scenes than, you know, parts of East Germany have bigger scenes than parts of West Germany.
Prague, interestingly enough, I've noticed it's kind of reverting back to almost Soviet. Old school. Just in the last couple of years, like 3 years, it got really Western, and I've noticed there's like a little pullback right now.
I imagine that's sort of like as you know, people that were raised with the old system get into positions of power, wanting to kind of
maybe
hold on to it for a little bit or something. Yeah. Like in those places, were kids like Guns N' Roses fans, or were you playing mainly just like rock fans? Like they were smuggling tapes, or like,
yeah, they were smuggling tapes. Yeah.
Can I say that Axl brought us to these places in 2010. We opened up for Guns N' Roses.
In
Romania, in Russia.
Russia?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. He brought us to Moscow and St. Petersburg.
How was it?
It was pretty fucking wild.
Yeah.
But there was a couple of places where there were like bootleggers, and they had all the.
That's in England too. You see that, the bootleggers in England too.
Yeah, they're outside. There's a. It's just that it was an arena, and then outside they had like GNR everything.
When we played Russia last time, the hats, after party got raided.
T-shirts, everything.
Yeah, the party we had, it got raided by the cops, and they watched us sleep all night, and it was terrifying. And I'm never going back.
To Russia.
Yeah, it was crazy. They raided this party we were in. Not a party by anyone's definition. I'm sure back in the day, Guns N' Roses would be very ashamed of us to even call it a party. It was very mild. But the police showed up, and our friends who were Russian were like, we're just not going to let them in. And eventually they let them in, and they let the Russian kids go. They took the promoters to jail for the night, Vice Russia. And then they're like, as they're leaving, they're like, the police are going to stay and watch you sleep. And everyone else in the band drinks, and I don't drink at all, so I'm wide awake, just listening to this police officer's radio go off in the room, and everyone else in the band is kind of passed out at this point.
What, like at the club?
No, this is like across the street in an apartment that they had rented us for the night, like a hotel apartment type thing. And the police officer came in there and stayed with us all night.
What was the reasoning behind that?
They had eventually kind of found out that this apartment had been used like 2 or 3 years ago to make porno movies. And had been raided back then, and someone filed a noise complaint against us, and the police, I guess, were like, the porno people are back.
More porn.
Came running back full force. And then
fucked
stayed.
What?
Yeah,
fucked up.
What? What are you band doing? You're fucking in here? So.
Right.
So yeah, Russia. Yeah, you should go though. It's really fun.
Yeah, I will go eventually, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I was a little disappointed when we did all these GNR dates with Axl. And then when they were all done, I heard the news that you went on stage and you played Tommy's bass and you got up on stage and you played a song
in London. Yeah.
Yeah. And how was that? How was that whole?
It was cool. I mean, it was totally unexpected. I was in London on not even music business. I was there.
Yeah.
I went there on business and the hotel I always usually stay at there, the manager. The hotel, I was with my wife and he was taking us up to our room. I'm like, this is full service.
Yeah.
And he asked, you're playing tonight? And I'm not playing. Okay. You're not playing tonight? No. And it turns out that the guys were staying in the hotel and Axel's room was right next to mine. And then the manager started freaking out. And it was, I just took that as a sign. It was time. And I just went and knocked on the door and hung out and talked and had a good time.
That's awesome.
But I was really out of it and jet lagged. I'd been flying. I wouldn't have gone to any other gig. I almost didn't go. I was just tired. And I drank some Red Bull and we went down to the gig together, Axl and I, and got up and played a couple songs. And, you know, I had my BlackBerry on the side of the stage. And I came back to it, and the thing was just blowing up because that's how quickly news, that, especially news.
Well, Twitter,
like that.
That's post Twitter, post Facebook, post.
And my email and my text were just going. And, you know, you like that kind of a thing, you don't really. Like, you know what? You want it to be more private. Like, just us hanging out was probably cool. That's. But then it gets public, you know, by playing a couple rock songs.
And it becomes something else.
It became something else. Yeah. But it was great. It was fine.
Well, speaking of reunions and controversial reunions of sorts, you've played with Ron from Flag.
I talked to Ron when I heard the news. I called him like 2 weeks ago.
And you're friends with Ron Reyes,
the Black Flag
from Black Flag, and you've also been with Dez Kadena in bands.
Dez was in Loaded.
Who's in Loaded? The original line.
Dez Kadena was in.
He's like the original guitarist, right?
I did not know that.
Taz Bentley from Reverend Horton.
Yeah, the drummer.
And Dez and Michael from Plexi. So that was the original.
Yeah, the first kind of
OG
thing.
OG lineup.
So having been in both bands, are you gonna? Go to Flag, both Flag reunions?
I'm gonna have to. I mean, I have no
no allegiance.
No, I'm like.
You should.
I'm gonna go see Dez.
Yeah.
And Dez knows my girls.
Yeah.
Dez knows my girls since Grace was born, and of course I'll
go to the Ron one too.
Of course, I wish you'd just do.
Yeah, it's like Floyd.
You know, it's like the two Pink Floyds touring. It's like we have two black flags now.
Yeah, it's the last thing you...
Oh, okay.
10 minutes?
Yes.
Wow.
10 minutes we to talk... what? To Showtime?
Yes.
Scotty?
Yes.
10 minutes to Showtime?
Yes. We talked for a long time.
Fucking hell. I gotta get ready?
Yeah.
I'm on stage in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Motherfucker.
Well, ladies and gentlemen of Danko Jones Podcast, we're going to have to wrap this up here.
We're going to have to end the rock. Hey, this has been amazing. And I didn't even get to talk to you about The Living, which there might be a reissue coming out of
here. I guess, yeah, it's been in works for...
forever.
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 I think they went under it for a while.
Will there be a 10-minute warning reissue too, probably then? Is this going to be the beginning? Study. All right, we'll end it now.
Study, this has been the whole podcast.
You're not playing this podcast. You're going to want to listen to the shit out of this.
I will.
It's going to be amazing.
Thanks, Tom.
All right.
Thanks, man. Come on. Excellent.